Definitely no more than 12 of them at a push.
You asked how I plan to take this planet single-handed, Doctor, the Barvon Shi jeered between the horses. The answer is, I don't.
The Doctor studied the advancing women. They'd been human once, certainly. Some of them still dressed in the clothes they'd died in, stained with blood. Some young, some old, withered corpses struggling to fill tight corsets. But now they'd been transformed. All humanity had been stolen away from them, their identities lost, their bodies brutally twisted from their natural shape. Parasitic DNA, the Doctor guessed, corrupting their biology. Am I right? But again, the Barvon Shi didn't offer any answers. Instead, she simply waited for the creatures to surround them, just as the Doctor and his men had surrounded her before. Then the women stopped a safe distance from the horses, holding out their hands in supplication, their talon-like nails beckoning the men to join them.
Dance with us,
they chorused, foul saliva dripping down their fangs, drooling down their faces as the men stared, shifting where they sat.
They're beautiful, Wesley murmured. Oh no, the Doctor urged them. Remember what I said. Stay on your horses. Close your eyes and don't move.
But it was too late. The Barvon creatures had already lured the men down from the safety of their saddles and were now advancing upon them, their clear blue eyes shining violently through the darkness. The Doctor looked round helplessly as the women started picking the men apart, the creatures' sharp white fangs descending upon their victims in some twisted hedonistic frenzy. Even the horses started backing away in revulsion, inadvertently releasing the Barvon Shi from the confines of her horseshoe prison. Then there was a crack, and one of the women howled victoriously into the cold night air, letting the youngest man's body fall to the earth at her feet. Dead. The Doctor turned away in protest, glaring down at the Barvon Shi ahead of him, when suddenly he noticed another woman shrouded in the fog, standing quite apart from the rest of the group. She was watching them, studying the others intently, almost enviously. He could just about see her eyes, shining coolly through the misty haze between them. She could never have seen her own kind feast before, the Doctor realized. She must be new. Then as the creature advanced towards the pack, the Doctor thought he recognized her. Her chestnut hair, her muted clothes, skin somewhat paler than it ought to have been. It couldn't be. Could it? A gentle breeze cleared the mist between them, and there wasn't any doubt. It was Charity. Her chocolate-brown gown now soaked with blood, her eyes shining brightly from their sockets, burning into his very soul. The Doctor felt a lump form tightly in his throat, choking him as he spoke.
I told you to stay, and I told you I could never leave, she countered accusingly, a harsh edge cutting through her voice. I wanted to help you, to help everyone. We were going to rid the land of this eternal darkness together. But now I've found something better than you.
She turned to face the Barvon Shi and smiled.
I never realized you could feel this way. Suddenly, I'm so much more alive.
But this isn't life, the Doctor insisted. Only death. That's all these creatures are about. Can't you see? Charity looked around her at the creatures that had changed her.
No, she uttered blankly in reply. But I'll tell you what I can see, Doctor. I can see colours I never knew existed. Emotions I've never felt. All manner of thoughts and concepts and songs. The whole of existence brought to life in front of me. Things I don't even have words for. Civilization spread across the depths of space. 1,000 different worlds and 100 different galaxies. Everywhere the Barvon Shi has vanquished.
The Doctor watched as her eyes burned steadily brighter, the pupils boiling cyan, alive with a vile combination of derision and scorn.
And I can see this world, Charity continued, relishing her newfound perspective on life. This Earth, hanging in space, at the center of a million different planets.
But not yours. Is that right, Doctor? What happened to your world? The Doctor flinched, taking in a single deep breath to steel himself against her onslaught of taunts. She's got inside your head, he told her calmly.
And I am but an extension of her, Charity replied. She lives through me as I do them. We are one and the same.
Then she broke off abruptly, offering up a cold, pale hand towards him.
Dance with me, Doctor, she pleaded. Make me feel better.
Enough, the Barvon Shi barked wearily, cutting them off. I have my own score to settle with this man.
And all because I didn't want to dance, the Doctor scoffed. You must be great to have round parties.
I said enough, the creature cried again, bringing her long, claw-like hands up to the sides of her skull, massaging her temples with her fingertips. She closed her eyes and let rip a sigh of satisfaction. Suddenly, the Doctor felt another chill pulse through his head, and instinctively he knew she was trying to get inside again. But he could resist her. Now he knew what she was doing. If he concentrated hard enough. Then he heard her laughing, a short, horrible chuckle rippling through the darkness as an ugly grimace spread across her lips.
I recognize your mind, Time Lord, she said as her cold blue eyes flicked open, fixing them directly onto his. I've seen your kind before. Your stubbornness, your corruption, your misguided sense of superiority. And we did feast on them.
But that's impossible, the Doctor growled. At the back of his mind, he knew she was trying to lure him down, just like she had the others. And yet, the more she spoke, the harder he found it to restrain himself.
We drank from your race once before, the Barvon Shi continued, licking her lips together playfully as she spoke. So very long ago now. Back when that so-called society of yours was still in its infancy. When they willingly gave up their lives, watching as entire systems perished around your pathetic little world. And oh, how we did feast.
The Doctor felt the rage bubbling up inside him. But they defeated you, he spat.
And now I seek to repay that debt. But I would never kill you, Doctor.
The Barvon Shi purred in as reassuring a manner as she could muster.
Not when I know your blood will taste so very succulent. On the contrary, I will do my utmost to ensure your survival to the end of time. Believe me.
She smacked her lips together again, almost theatrically, throwing a subtle little nod to some of the other Barvon creatures behind him. The Doctor watched curiously as they edged through the undergrowth towards him, slowly at first, then with an unexpected confidence.
"Did you really expect me not to notice that?" he asked, clinging all the more tightly to the safety of Henry's saddle. "The fact is, none of you can lay a finger on me while I'm up here, and you know it. Ha!"
He laughed with satisfaction, then noticed the women still advancing all around him, the Barvon Shi's eyes glinting mercilessly through the gloom.
"Is that a fact?" she asked. "Are you truly inaccessible to us, Time Lord?"
Yes, the Doctor stumbled. "At least, I think so. Aren't I?"
"And yet, that horse does not belong to you," the Barvon Shi continued. "It is the property of one Mr. Abraham Godchild, is it not? A man of not inconsiderable means."
"Well, I don't think he was poor, if that's what you're saying," the Doctor agreed. The Barvon's eyes grew brighter as they advanced.
"Some might even have said he was an extravagant man," their leader persisted, her eyes flicking down to the ground at the Doctor's feet. "Indulgent. Overstated. Decadent."
"Sorry," the Doctor interrupted, "but I'm really not sure where you're going with this." Then he noticed Charity suddenly standing alongside him, her cold, clammy hand tapping him lightly on the shoulder.
"Silver horseshoes," she said, pointing at the hooves beneath his feet. "Not iron."
"Oh," the Doctor sighed, and even Henry seemed to shrug some kind of apology. Then he turned his attention back to the Barvon Shi, a wicked smile splitting across her face. "You were right," the Doctor told her. "Extravagant."
"And yet, more than a little convenient for us, don't you think?"
The Doctor hesitated. "Well, a little more convenient, perhaps," he admitted. "But you seem to have forgotten one tiny little detail."
"And what's that?" asked the Barvon Shi.
"This is me you're dealing with," The doctor pulled tightly on the reins in his hands, prompting Henry to rear up violently beneath him, knocking a couple of the nearby Barvon creatures off their feet in the process. The Barvon covered their ears as the doctor whistled loudly, a high-pitched shriek that only animals could hear, and within seconds he found the remaining three horses at his side, unwittingly keeping the Barvon threat at bay. He didn't miss a beat. The moment there was another horse at his side, the doctor leapt clumsily onto its saddle, steadying himself across its back as he landed. He was safe, for now at least.
"You can't escape the darkness, Doctor," the Barvon Shi screamed. "I've been skulking in the shadows for weeks, biding my time. But I tell you now, this ends tonight."
"Oh, I couldn't agree more," the doctor smiled back at her. Then he tugged sharply on the reins of his brand new horse, whispering a few words of encouragement into its ear, and quickly found himself galloping back through the dense dark woods to Thornton Rising. The Barvon Shi looked round her pathetic troop of converts, most of whom were still cowering in the undergrowth, terrified of the three remaining horses. She cocked her head furiously to the heavens and howled. Already the doctor and his steed were nowhere to be seen. The darkness had swallowed them up almost immediately, the thick Barvon mist obscuring them from vision. As the doctor and his horse galloped swiftly back to Thornton, a mob had once again settled in the village square, the incensed howls of the Barvon Shi having alerted them to the oncoming threat. The doctor leapt down from his horse just outside the tavern, and the villagers flocked around him almost immediately, demanding answers. Where were the others? What had they found? What had made those noises in the night? The doctor tried to calm them down, but failed. Still, the questions came. Were they safe? Was something coming for them? Would they ever see the sunrise again? In the end, the doctor couldn't help himself. "Quiet!" he shouted, trying to overwhelm them. His voice cut through the village like a knife, and instantly the villagers fell silent. "Thank you," he added, adjusting his tie roughly around his neck. "Now then, to answer just a few of your questions, first of all, no, it's just me. The others didn't listen to me, which is why you need to now. Secondly, yes, there is something coming, and yes, it made those noises. But we can stop it. Thirdly, or rather fourthly, I think I just answered two questions at once there, yes, you'll all be safe. But only if you listen to me and do exactly as you're told. Got that?" A reluctant nod spread across the crowd like a half-hearted Mexican wave. "Brilliant," said the doctor, clapping his hands together. "Because you need to defend yourselves. Lock yourselves away. Don't go looking for a fight. And if you have anything iron in your homes, absolutely anything at all, use it. That's their weakness." He could hear a disapproving murmur brewing. "Any questions?" he asked.
"Yes," called one of the men. "What are you going to do?"
"I'm going to end this," the doctor announced. "Now then, any others? Anything at all?" As he looked round the villagers, the doctor suddenly caught sight of Nate standing amongst them. His eyes seemed to be asking an altogether different question. Where was she, Doctor? His beloved Charity. Was she safe? But before the doctor could bring himself to offer any kind of answer, another voice disturbed him, drawing his attention back to the mob at large.
"Tell me," the voice demanded gruffly, "why should we let you take on these demons instead of us?"
"These creatures are like nothing any of you have ever seen before," the doctor insisted. "They're not demons, they're not animals, but they are extremely intelligent. They will rip out your souls, feast upon your carcasses, and change you into creatures just like them."
"But we're men, aren't we?"
an older man screamed back at him.
"We can fight our own battles. Who's with me?"
The crowd cheered raucously in agreement. "In which case," the doctor warned them bluntly, "you die. Tonight." Before the men could even begin to argue, an ominous rumble filled the air, cutting them off. Like a thunderclap, but somehow different. Like it was emanating from all around them, not from above. The doctor watched with the villagers as a massive bolt of lightning struck the abbey in the distance, throttling its way along the spire. Then he realised there was something wrong, something odd about it. The abbey wasn't being struck by lightning at all. Instead, the lightning was being shot into the sky from the abbey, an electrical pulse that lasted mere fractions of a second. He watched as the chaotic arcs of energy connected with the clouds, spreading out across the sky above them, and then down. The doctor watched in awe as the sheets of lightning fell back into the earth, a good few miles away, as if they were following some existing pattern, some kind of shape, a dome. Of course, the Doctor realised. That's brilliant! A force field created from the Abbey, cutting everywhere off. But why this place? And why block out all the light? He noticed the other villagers staring at him blankly. Yeah, he apologised, sucking in the air between his teeth. I could try and explain, only you wouldn't understand, and you'd probably mistake me for a demon again, so I won't. Now please, I'm asking you nicely, just go back to your homes and do as you're told. There's a nice mob, and remember, most important of all, iron. And with that, the Doctor started running. The villagers stood their ground as the thick, unearthly mist rolled in around them, half in protest, half in ignorance. They'd never seen anything like it before. It was as if the fog itself was alive somehow, glowing eerily, pulsating like a heartbeat, bringing something with it through the darkness. A few of the villagers returned to their homes. Some decided to follow the Doctor's orders, barricading the doors and windows, locking themselves away. Others returned with pitchforks and other household implements, anything they had to hand, anything they might yet be able to defend themselves with. They looked around the square, brandishing their makeshift weapons like swords, just waiting for their enemy to strike, the mist having now engulfed the village completely. Wherever they turned, the thick white haze obscured their vision, limiting it to just a few metres ahead of them. And yet, in the distance, a few of them could see something. Tully noticed it first, like a pair of blue specks, hanging in the air on the other side of the square. Then Mr. Bradshaw spotted them, followed by Mr. Phillips and Mr. Thorpe. Within moments, the entire mob had their eyes fixed on the strange pair of lights leering at them from the other side of the village. Which meant they didn't notice the second pair of lights appear behind them, or the others spreading out around them. In fact, it was only when they saw five pairs of the glowing specks lined up ahead of them that they realised they had been surrounded. Wherever they turned, they were there, hanging in the air, their enemy's cold blue eyes burning through the gloom. Suddenly, the men saw a snatch of blue shoot past them, leaping through the air, knocking Tully to the ground with a smack. He screamed as the creature started feasting on him, clawing at his flesh, scratching at his clothes, running its fangs across his neck with a savage sense of glee. The other men stepped back, rallying themselves, looking for some kind of sanctuary. But they couldn't see anything, just the pinpricks of blue light blinking in the darkness ahead of them. Tully's scream stopped suddenly with a whimper, and they knew he must be dead. They could even see the creature looking up at them, hunger in its eyes, almost as if it was trying to work out who'd be next. Then something interrupted them. Now the screams had stopped, the men could hear something else approaching through the woods, the steady thud of hooves across the earth. As they looked up, they could see four more specks of blue thundering into the village, the Bar von She and Henry, the horse's eyes glowing just like hers. The men looked on in horror as she rode into the centre of the square, screaming out her orders through the darkness. "None must be allowed to speak of our existence," she roared, blood already dripping down her lips. "Our ranks shall spread themselves across the earth in secret. A dominion ruled by darkness, with this township at the centre of our empire." She smiled at the crowd of terrified men in front of her. "Purge this place," she commanded. "Go and feed upon this world." The Barvon women's howls echoed round the village as the men shrank back into the mist looking for escape. But all they could see were the missing women of their village, treading steadily closer, closing in around them. Then the screaming started. By the time the Doctor reached the Abbey, he could already hear the villagers' cries howling on the wind. Maybe one day someone might listen to him, he thought. They might learn to take his advice and save themselves. He pulled the sonic screwdriver from his jacket pocket, but he had no chance to activate it. The doors to the Abbey flew open almost automatically, groaning under their own weight. "How'd you do that?" he asked. Then he noticed a figure in the doorway, tall and cowled, the hood of his thick dark robe draped across his eyes, hiding them from sight. The Doctor stepped forwards, holding out a hand, the sonic screwdriver still clutched tightly in the other. "Hello there," he said, circling round the stranger. "Really sorry to disturb you like this. You must be the abbot." The figure nodded solemnly, gesturing for the Doctor to step inside. "Thank you," the doctor said, following him through the doors. And I meant what I said. I really am very sorry, but I need to look around, if you don't mind. The abbot threw his hands open in response, motioning round the abbey, granting the doctor access to anywhere and everywhere he wanted. At least that's how the doctor chose to interpret it. Brilliant, the doctor smiled, as he aimed the sonic screwdriver round the chamber, down the nave, along the aisles. It whirred as he walked, then started bleating more steadily as he stepped into the apse. He followed its signal slowly round the room when he found a staircase hidden in a corner tucked away, leading down into a crypt beneath the abbey itself. Bingo, the doctor grinned, thrusting the sonic screwdriver back into his pocket. Then he turned to the abbot, already knowing he wouldn't get a reply, but still. Wish me luck, he beamed. The abbot smiled and watched as the doctor disappeared down the staircase, vanishing into the gloom beneath them. Then there was silence. Back in the heart of Thornton Rising, the screams had stopped, just for a minute. Amidst the chaos of the initial attacks, the villagers had spread themselves across the village square, losing track of one another in the mist. Now many of them were alone, trying desperately to escape, hoping beyond hope that the Barvan might kill their friends before themselves. But this was all part of the game. The Barvan Shi knew how the men would react. She knew how to strike terror in their hearts. Now the villagers had seen what they were capable of. She was dragging out their deaths. Now each of them knew how they were going to die. She could hear them even now scurrying across the square, trying to keep quiet. Some of them even trying not to breathe. But she knew that they were there. She could taste them. Their hearts throbbing, blood racing, their pathetic human fear filling the air. And she enjoyed it. If she could make this last forever, then she would. For the time being, she was content to watch them turn on one another, just as she knew humans always would. Whenever she sensed their feeble hearts beginning to slow, whenever they threatened to relax, even for a moment, she would send another of her sisters out to pick them off, one by one, all to let the others know how slow their deaths would be. And their deaths were inevitable now. There was no escape from the Barvan Shi. Each man could be next, or he could be last. But each would die, and the longer the wait for death, the greater that sense of dread became, until some of them would simply die of fright. Now enough time had passed. She could feel them starting to calm themselves again, and so she gestured to another of her sisters. Almost instantly a man's scream could be heard ripping across the night. Then the Barvan Shi heard another sound, buried beneath the shrieking, a man's footsteps crossing the village square. It was Nate. Even now, he was still searching for Charity, desperately trying to find her before they did. He only knew it was too late when he turned to find himself face to face with another of the creatures, its cool sapphire eyes glaring into him. Finally, he'd found her. Charity? He asked, his voice now riddled with confusion. But the creature simply held a long, cold finger to his lips and hushed him, refusing to answer. Maybe she didn't know if she was Charity Wentworth anymore. She'd changed so much, so quickly. Who knew what she was? Then he felt her take his hand into hers.
Dance with me, she whispered into his ear. Please.
Nate knew he shouldn't, that this creature wasn't his wife anymore. And yet, he knew he wouldn't be able to refuse her. He never could. A cold drop of water hit the top of the doctor's head, causing him to yelp as he stepped further into the chamber ahead of him. He looked around, holding out the sonic screwdriver, hoping he might spot some sort of clue within the crypt. But it was clear that centuries of neglect had not been kind to it. The room was dark, dank, the freezing temperatures, a constant reminder that he was now deep beneath the earth. And yet, as he felt his way deeper into the darkness, he could tell the walls were smooth, polished, not stone at all, and they hummed with a faint trace of energy. Nothing obvious, nothing that might draw attention to itself. Just everyday background activity. The simple signs of a spaceship on standby. Then the doctor thought he heard the wall click in front of him, so he waved the sonic screwdriver across it, and it clicked again. Must be some kind of locking mechanism, he thought. He ran his fingers quickly over the wall where he could just about make out the vague shape of a door set into the panels. He stepped back, adjusting the settings on the sonic screwdriver, aiming it directly at the wall ahead of him. It clicked again, then again, and again, like a series of sophisticated bolts unlocking themselves from within. When the sequence stopped, the Doctor watched with fascination as a panel slid back into the grooves of the wall, revealing a brand new room hidden away behind it. He peered through the hatch. It was the flight deck. He recognised elements of it from the crash, from when he'd felt the memories of the Bar Von Shi in his. Now he saw it all in front of him again. The complex terminals and machinery charred and devastated on impact. The entire room bathed in the dull blue glow of emergency lighting. Only a handful of cracked video screens still flickering with any kind of activity. The Doctor immediately ran across to one of the panels, examining it with a sonic screwdriver, trying to coax it back to life. He'd guessed there was something strange about the Abbey from the moment he saw it. There was something about the shape, as though it had been built around another structure first. Though he hadn't quite expected that structure to be an advanced form of extraterrestrial spacecraft. He continued to examine the equipment, exploring each and every panel, when one of the terminals suddenly chirped into life beside him. It had already been active, and quite recently too. The Doctor watched as facts and figures flickered across the screen. Information massing, gathering, collecting itself together in front of his very eyes. Most of it useless, some of it useful. Life support protocols, defense mechanisms, details of the Bar Von ceremonial dining etiquette, and a computer program. A protective shield that had been set up around the village, not to keep things out, but to keep people in. That's what he'd seen outside, of course! An electrical pulse, transmitted through the air at regular intervals to maintain a barrier. And if it had been programmed in just the right way, then maybe... Yes! The Doctor's hands rattled across the keyboard as he called up even more information about the program, what it did, what it was capable of. And he was right. It had been programmed to corrupt the optical spectrum around the village, not exactly blocking out the light, but filtering it, stopping it getting through. He'd seen creatures like this before. Races that were photosensitive, that could be destroyed by different forms of light, some infrared, others X-tonic, in this case, ultraviolet. That's why the Bar Von Shi had set the program up, to protect herself. Which meant, if he switched it off... The Doctor shook his head. He couldn't do it. If he did, the Bar Von women wouldn't stand a chance. Even if they endured just the briefest exposure to sunlight, they'd be reduced to dust after a matter of minutes. And that included Charity. She was still in the early stages of conversion, he thought. Maybe he could save her somehow. Reverse the process. There was always hope, wasn't there? Another scream cracked through the air, and suddenly there wasn't any doubt. He had to do it. He stabbed a series of keys on the terminal again, rifling through its complex array of security procedures. He ran the sonic screwdriver across the edges of the screen, altering its instructions, disabling the shield above the village. There was no going back. Not now. Then confirmation flickered across the screen in front of him. The barrier had been terminated, its defensive capabilities disabled. Permanently. And yet, the screaming continued. He could hear it from outside. Not the Bar Von Shi and her sisters, but the same man he'd heard before, one of the villagers. Something had gone wrong. As the Doctor ran from the Abbey, it struck him almost instantly. He could tell from the sky that the barrier had been lowered. Stars now twinkled faintly between the clouds, and the moon hung heavy in the sky. But it was October, the days were short, and a new dawn had yet to rise. There was still hope, though. Even now he could just about make out the faintest hint of daylight on the horizon. All he had to do was buy them some time, let nature take its course. If it wasn't already too late... The screams grew steadily louder as he darted back into the village square, the Bar Von Shi still playing her vicious game of hide-and-seek through the fog. But she heard him, skidding through the gravel. She recognised his scent, and for the first time that night, the villagers weren't the only ones to be afraid. "Listen to me," the Doctor screamed. "I've disabled the barrier. You can leave, all of you. You just have to run." The Bar Von Shi howled in rage to her sisters. "Kill them all!" she shrieked. "Not one man must be left alive." Suddenly the air was filled with bodies flying across the village square. the Barvon women leaping on their prey, picking them off one by one. But the villagers had hope now, and they were already running, faster and faster, making it even more difficult for the Barvon creatures to track them through the mist. Even when one of the creatures did get lucky, most of the men were already moving fast enough to shake them off and lose them in all the confusion. "Head for the east," the doctor ordered. He watched as the villagers did as they were told, their feet scrambling helplessly across the gravel paths. Then he saw the Barvon she approaching through the mist, looking proudly down at him from the safety of her saddle.
"And what makes you think you're so safe, Doctor?" she sneered.
"Oh, nothing," the doctor smiled. "Though I did borrow these from the Abbey." He pulled a pair of ornate wrought iron door handles from the confines of his pockets, holding them out, keeping her at arm's length. The Barvon she snorted angrily at him, and the pair started circling one another in the centre of the square, the chaos of battle raging all around them. "It's only a matter of time now," the doctor told her.
"Until what?" she hissed.
"Until the daylight catches up with you." Already he could see some of the Barvon creatures giving up the chase, running back into the safety of the village, their bodies starting to smoulder as they fled into the shadows.
"There's nowhere like this for miles," the doctor continued. "And all the buildings are locked. Nowhere safe for you to hide. You're exposed to the elements."
Suddenly a scream erupted from the shadows behind him as one of the Barvon women burst into a ball of yellow flame. The doctor saw the flash flicker across the eyes of the Barvon she.
"You think this is the end for us?" she asked.
"I don't just think," the doctor told her. "I know." Already he could feel the warm glow of the sun's rays on his face, comforting him, reassuring him that he'd made the right decision. A sensation he knew must have been agony for her. And yet she stood her ground, the screams of her sisters still echoing around them.
"You made this happen," she reminded him, smoke already rising from her shoulders. "Our race stops because of you."
"I know," the doctor agreed as he took a step towards her, gently patting Henry on the muzzle.
"And I'm so, so sorry." Because the doctor knew what was coming next. The dark veil had dropped. Their time had come. And he watched as the Barvon she began to blister, tears now rolling down her cheeks, boiling away against her flesh. Her once powerful body wasting away beneath the sun, evaporating as a new day dawned. She looked to the doctor, her cold blue eyes now faltering.
"What right have you to do this?"
she demanded weakly. But the doctor couldn't answer. Instead, he simply turned away, trying to forget. About her, about Charity, about so many different people and places and times. 9 centuries worth of regret.
"Your time is yet to come, Time Lord," the Barvon she screamed with her dying breath. "And sooner than you think."
Then the doctor felt a sudden blast of heat on the back of his neck, and he knew at once that it was over. For a good while afterwards, the doctor simply sat there, alone in the village square, waiting for the mist to clear, the day to dawn, surveying the devastation all around him. Dead men were strewn across the village where they lay, their bodies drained of blood, their terrified eyes still open wide as though searching for someone to save them. But no one could. There was no longer any sign of the Barvon she or her sisters. Only mounds of ash and bone, charred by the sun. And even those remains soon vanished, scattered on the breeze, lost forever to the winds. He'd had to do it. The doctor watched each grain of ash sweep by, closed each of the dead men's eyes. The minutes passed, so slowly they seemed like hours. Then a lone voice broke the silence. A voice the doctor recognised at once. It belonged to the only man still left in Thornton Rising. The one man he'd known would never flee, not for anything in the world, not for Charity. But she was gone now, just like the rest of them.
"Doctor!"
He tried desperately to ignore it, but the voice called out again, cracking gently under the stress of what had happened.
"Doctor!"
And footsteps, a man running towards him. Nathaniel. The doctor bowed his head towards the ground and turned to face him. I really am so, so sorry.
Don't be,
Nate interrupted, a look of desperation on his face. Just promise me you'll help me. Help my charity. I can't, the doctor told him weakly. Don't you see? But he didn't fully understand what Nate was telling him.
She danced with me, doctor, Nate explained, pointing urgently back towards their home. She danced with me to save me from the others.
His gestures were growing more frantic now.
She spared my life, so I saved hers. She's at home right now, cowering in the shadows, waiting for me, and you.
He swallowed hard as the doctor's gaze met his.
She doesn't want to die, he choked. Do you think that maybe you could help her? Please.
The doctor looked towards the house, then back to Nate.
Yes, he promised, taking in the deepest of breaths. I think I can help. I just need to track something down first. Something I lost on the moors.
Minutes passed, then hours. Nate looking after Charity all the while, when suddenly there was a cold, harsh series of raps on their door. And as he went to answer, Nate found himself confronted by a tall, forbidding figure in the doorway, his silhouette blocked out against the sunlight. It was the doctor. Behind him, Nate could just about see a tall blue box standing in the middle of the village square not so far away. Perhaps that contained the tools of his trade, Nate thought. Perhaps the doctor could help save Charity after all. Neither said a word as the doctor stepped inside, the door creaking slowly shut behind him. Charity was skulking in the shadows now, just as Nate had said. So pitiful and scared. The skin on her hands faintly blistered where they'd been struck by daylight, where she had held them up against the sun to protect herself. She whimpered lowly as the doctor approached.
Leave us, he ordered Nate, knowing it was the hardest request for a husband to meet. Please. And for the sake of his wife, Nate did as he was asked and left. The doctor removed the sonic screwdriver from his pocket and studied his patient. He crouched down beside her and took her in his arms. Are you all right? He asked. But Charity didn't reply. Instead, she looked the doctor over once again, her cold, sapphire eyes still burning fiercely in their sockets. Nate told me you dance with him, he said softly. Is that right? She nodded.
I had her mind in mine, remember? Charity replied. I knew what they'd do to him if I didn't.
The head of the sonic screwdriver retreated back into its handle and the doctor thrust it back inside his jacket. There was no way of reversing the process. The conversion was too far gone.
I meant what I said before, she told him, interrupting his train of thought. About your world, about all the worlds I saw burning so brightly in the heavens. And you were right. From the very beginning you warned me about yourself, what you are, what you do to people. Perhaps you are a real demon after all.
He just wants you to be safe, the doctor said.
I know.
Charity sat in silence for a moment, looking round her kitchen, at the stove, the table, the chairs, the crockery. This had been her world before today, her entire life trapped in just one room, in just one house, in just one village. But now she knew there was more to life than this.
People will soon return to this place, won't they, Doctor?
Yes, he answered simply.
And when they do, what will they make of me?
I think you already know the answer to that. Don't you? He sighed. But I can help. I can take you away from here. Both of you, if that's what you want. You and Nate. You could start a new life together, anywhere in the universe. On a planet where the sun need never rise. A world consumed by darkness. Just one trip. That's all it'd take. Charity remembered how the doctor had made the very same offer to the Barvon Shi herself. And she remembered what he'd done when she refused. All her life she yearned for something more, wished for something beyond her understanding. And now she found herself drowning in a million new sensations, her newfound perspective on life threatening to overwhelm her. And it was hurting her. She caught herself sobbing between breaths, gently choking on decisions she didn't want to make. Then the doctor rested a reassuring hand on her shoulder and she turned to face him.
I can't ruin his life too, she said.
Her eyes seemed softer now, more human, their fierce contempt smouldering away like the embers of a fire, teardrops glimmering gently in the gloom.
I only ever moved out here so I could be with him, she continued. Maybe if I hadn't...
I know, the doctor hushed, holding her close to him. Believe me, I know. They sat for a minute, comforting one another in the darkness, when suddenly the doctor stood abruptly. She looked up. He was holding out his hand. So, the doctor asked. Which is it to be? Thornton Rising? Or the rest of the universe? Charity didn't have an answer to give him. Not just yet. But still she took his hand, allowing the doctor to haul her to her feet. By the time Nate returned, Charity and the doctor were nowhere to be seen. The TARDIS doors swung open, and the doctor bounded idly up the ramp to the control console. Good, isn't it? He asked, leaving Charity to follow up behind him. But she just stood there, lingering in the doorway, utterly speechless. Is that a good open-mouthed or a bad open-mouthed? He asked. I never can tell anymore.
Good, I think,
she stammered as she edged into the TARDIS, following the doctor up the ramp, one careful, cautious step at a time. She struggled to take it all in at first. The size, the scale of it. This massive space, sounds flitting all around her. She looked up. A bright, unearthly light shone through a series of small round windows picked out in the strangely textured walls. And the walls themselves curved inwards, joining with one another in the roof to form one massive inner dome. Where they met at the centre of the structure, a column of pure white energy shot down to the floor through the central console, gathering together in a tall glass tube. And Charity could feel it. In the air beneath the walls, power crackling at the heart of the chamber.
Is this the world you spoke of? She asked.
No, this is the TARDIS, best transport the universe has to offer. And with it, I can take you anywhere in time and space. And oh, so much more.
Charity wiped a tear from the corner of her eye. What do you think? He asked. Reckon this is something you could live with? It's still your choice, remember?
I know, Charity reassured him. And I want to choose...
Good.
Because you're not just dropping me off on the first world we come to. If I do this, if we do this, I want to be able to make a proper choice, to find a world that's right for me. A world where I might still believe I'm who I used to be. Do you think we could do that?
Just one trip, that's what I said, the doctor reminded her. Then a smile spread across his face.
Mind you, I suppose if we were to bend the rules a little, one trip could still extend to 1,000 different worlds. Unless, of course, I don't know.
You already happen to have somewhere specific in mind? Charity shook her head. Not a clue.
Well, that's that then.
The doctor clapped his hands excitedly, dashing round the console, his feet skittering over the TARDIS's grated floor.
We'll find you that right world, Charity, I promise. And probably quite a few wrong ones, come to think of it. But remember, now you're here, we've got all the time in the world.
Literally. The doctor shot her one of his massive, childish grins, then Charity glanced back towards the door. There's still time to say goodbye, he told her quietly. If you want to. His hands hesitated momentarily over the handbrake. Do you want to? But Charity shook her head.
I know my perfect world's on the other side of those doors right now, she said. And if I go out there, if I even try to say goodbye to him, I'll never want to leave. And that's not fair on either of us, is it?
But the doctor didn't answer. He didn't need to. Instead, his long spidery fingers scurried quickly across the console, twisting and tweaking the controls beneath his hands. Finally, he slammed the handbrake down, hard.
I'd hold tight if I were you, he warned, whooping enthusiastically with the sound of the ship's engines. Second most perfect world in the universe, here we come!
And in spite of all the tears now rolling down her cheeks, Charity couldn't help but smile back at him. A strange alien doctor who had all of a sudden made her life worth living. Who, against all odds, had saved her. Nathaniel Wentworth stood alone in the cold, watching as the tall blue box vanished from existence before his very eyes. Temporal winds lashed gently at his face, and the strange otherworldly wheezing and groaning somehow told him he would never see his wife again. She'd made her decision, and he didn't doubt for a second that it had been the right one. For both of them. In that moment, Charity Wentworth ceased to exist forevermore, leaving in her wake the most beautiful sunset the world had ever seen. Golden orange clouds burnt deep into the sky, etched across the heavens. Nate struggled hard against the tears, sighing softly to himself. "Till death do us part," he whispered, hoping somehow that Charity might hear him. But she never did. She was already over a million light years away, across the stars, on the furthest fringes of an unknown galaxy, living on a world without light, without him. But she would always remember. They both would. Doctor Who, The Rising Knight was written by Scott Hancock and was read by Michelle Ryan. It was produced by Kate Thomas and is published by BBC Audiobooks.
"Scary, isn't it?" said Carl. Katie wasn't going to let her brother get to her. She wouldn't give him the satisfaction. "Of course not," she snapped. "What's there to be scared of?" Carl gestured at the dark trees surrounding them. "Oh, nothing. Except we're in an old dead wood at night. There's no one around for 100 miles. No radio or cell phone coverage. No lights. And no one to rescue you if something comes." "If the wood is dead," said Katie, "what's going to come?" Carl laughed and flicked on his torch. "Okay, you've got me there. That's the problem with you medical types, always so rational." Katie breathed in the cold night air. Wind rustled through the skeletal trees. "Ex-medical type," said Katie, "and I wouldn't be so sure. Something is ruining our experiments." Carl ran his torch beam over a small plastic pool sticking out of the uneven ground. "Here we are," he said. "Geosensor 412. Brother and sister knelt at the stubby object. Katie extracted a small toolkit from her coat pocket. She fiddled at the dead sensor's side. "I checked this 2 hours ago. Now the sensor's totally offline. It doesn't make sense." Carl nodded. "Of course not. That's why."
"Why what?"
"Why it's so scary." Katie slapped his arm. "Carl, stop it!" Although she would never tell him, Katie admitted to herself that yes, actually, she was scared. She didn't like the silence, the dark, the emptiness. Both she and Carl had come to the project from a lifetime in warm, loud cities. No one had lived in this country for 50 years. "What's that?" asked Carl. He shone his torch down a steep bank to a heavy black smudge, dark against the blue night. "The old bridge," said Katie. "Look at this." Katie looked. A line of earth was flattened, smooth as an oil slick. The smell of the ground was dry, gritty. "Like someone dragged something heavy down the bank," she murmured. Carl followed the smooth earth with his torch. "Goes all the way to the bridge." "We should go back," said Katie suddenly. What? Carl roared with laughter. You big baby, come on. What's the hurry? By the time we've contacted the others, we'd have lost track of whatever's wrecking our stuff. We've got to take a look. Carl slid down the scree on the bank and disappeared into the night, his thick torch beam swinging down below. Katie stood for a moment. She listened to the wind in the trees. Come on! Yelled Carl. The dark was total now. Then Katie remembered. She still had her own torch. All this time she'd had a light. Carl was right. She was a baby. Back in Madrid, she had prided herself on being so independent, a strong woman determined to be a doctor. But out here in the wasteland, she immediately fell apart, her brain freezing, clinging to her brother, for heaven's sake. Katie snapped her torch off her belt clip and fumbled the light on. Playing it ahead of her, she picked her way down the bank. Dust swirled around, as it always did when the rain hadn't fallen. Carl, she called out. She was standing in the old dry river. No water here, not for 100 years. Nothing but dried tree trunks and dust. And, of course, the bridge. She knew the bridge in the day. A functional brick arch supporting old railway lines across the river. The brickwork was covered in shriveled ivy. The railway lines rusted in the dirt. Just an old bridge across the River Brent. Just a bridge. Well, just a bridge in the day. Carl, she called again. Come on, have you found something? She watched the torch beam dart round under the near side arch. Carl was nothing but an ink blot. Suddenly, Katie was angry rather than scared. There was a job to do. Carl, stop mucking about, she snapped. Carl's black blob emerged from the shadows. He shone his light right in her eyes. Was he kneeling? Okay, said Katie. You've done it. You frighten me now. She heard a snuffle. A laugh? A sneeze? She pointed her torch at Carl's face. The black blob wasn't Carl. Katie realized her brother was gone, and there was no way she was going under that bridge. Not for anyone. Not even for him. She ran. She ran along the parched, uneven, dried-out riverbed, stumbling and falling and screaming. And then she collided with something. No, someone. Strong arms held her and she screamed again. Only this someone was different. A hand grabbed her torch, which she'd forgotten she'd been holding, and shone it on his face. Whoever he was, he smiled the most fantastic smile she had ever seen. It was a dark but not particularly stormy night, he said. I'm the Doctor. Hello. Doctor Who, The Day of the Trawl, by Simon Messingham. Read by David Tennant. The first sunlight eventually touched the landscape, and for the first time the Doctor could see where he was, in a steeply banked riverbed full of dead trees. There was no sound. No sound at all. Parched hills rose on all sides. The Doctor rubbed some soil between his hands. This isn't desert, it's more like drought, a long drought. It started to rain. Blobs of water spattered into the dust. Not drought, then. The girl moaned by his side. Throughout the night she had done nothing but stare. A moan is an improvement, the Doctor told her, cause for optimism. She was dressed very practically, all jumpsuit and pockets full of undoubtedly useful and necessary technical gadgets. A fur-lined fake leather coat kept her warm, and she was wearing some very expensive outdoor boots. Her blonde hair spilled out from beneath a blue cap. There was a round logo badge on the cap's brow with a picture of a tree full of leaves and lettering. The Grange. The Doctor put the cap on his own head. If it fits, he said. Come on, let's get you home. He led the girl by the hand up the tree trunk lined riverbank. Reaching the top, he saw there was no vegetation, just clouds overlying brown hills. The land was divided into large rectangular fields by coloured plastic tape. In each field, electronic poles grew out of the mud, sensors of some kind. The drizzle swept in waves across the ploughed earth. England, said the doctor. Has to be England.
My name is Carl Baring, and I need your help. You know me as an entrepreneur, but now my enterprise is to save the planet. Some say it's too late. The land is spoiled forever. Current forecasts say the Earth will run out of food in 70 years. Here at the Grange, we have a different view. We don't give up. Our scientists work in the long-abandoned countryside of southern Britain to make the crops grow again. Over 200 kilometres of agricultural experiments. But we can't do it on our own. I've put every euro I have into the Grange. Now it's your turn. Give what you can. There is no choice. We need food. Whether you're in Spain, Morocco, Thailand or Somalia, the UK is still your home. Give your grandchildren a chance to live. We are the Grange. And we are the future.
Petra Lancaster hit pause. The computer screen froze on Carl Baring's wise, charismatic, handsome face. The trim phone on her desk bleeped. With no satellite coverage or radio possible, these old-fashioned internal phones were, for the volunteers of the Grange, the only means of communication beyond a chat. Petra? Asked a timid voice. Can I come in? Only if you're bringing coffee. Dr. Timothy Hill was a sensitive soul who hated confrontation and wouldn't hurt a mouse. Unless that mouse bit one of his plants. He was the wrong kind of personality for this kind of work. His PhD in botany was an important reason for him being here. Although, Petra had to admit, not as important as his willingness to work for almost nothing when he could have been earning millions developing neocrops for a food corporation. The bearded, bespectacled scientist walked into Petra's study. He held out a mug. Coffee indeed, my own Kenyan hybrid blend. How did Carl's appeal go? Petra smiled. A great success. 300 million hits. Tim put the cup down on Petra's desk. That's great, just what we need. He looked at her. They both knew 300 million was well below what was necessary. Better tell His Majesty the good news, he said. Have you seen him? Petra asked. Carl, not since last night. He went with Katie to check on those damaged sensors. And when did he get back? Tim shrugged. I don't know. Do you think you might like to check? Tim smiled a weak smile, then pointed. Who's that? Petra looked through the study window to see a man wearing a Grange cap carrying Katie Baring into the grounds. What the hell? Petra snapped. The security in this place is a joke. She stormed out. What security? Tim's voice wafted after her. The doctor carried the girl up the gravel track to the stately home and had almost reached the stone steps leading to the main door when at last someone came to stop him. About time, he said to the woman dashing towards him. What happened to halt or I fire? Loudhailers. Normally I'm flashing ID, being shouted at and having guns brandished in my face way before now. Who are you? Stammered the woman, looking very harassed. That's better, the doctor smiled. I'm the doctor, and I think I've found someone you lost. He turned round to show off the girl. Katie? Asked the woman. Katie, nodded the doctor, as if he'd known all along. He knelt and lowered the girl to the ground. Considering the lack of physical injury, she had been unconscious for a worryingly long time. She collapsed halfway home. She's had a shock, he said. A bad one. The woman knelt too. The doctor saw a name badge reading Petra Lancaster and the same leafy tree logo. Where's Carl? Petra asked. I don't know. Who's Carl? Petra shouted, Charlie, Katie's been hurt. The doctor held up a document that clearly stated, to Petra at least, he was to be afforded the highest level clearance within Eurozone boundaries. Right then, he said, quickly returning the paper to his pinstripe jacket pocket. I'm the doctor, and as of now, I'm officially taking over this investigation. What investigation? Asked Petra. My investigation, said the doctor. If I didn't know better, the doctor said as they carried the still Katie Baring inside. I would have said this was an English country house. It is an English country house, Petra snapped. She hadn't even begun to trust him, even with the Eurozone credentials. In fact, because of those credentials, she trusted him even less. She had never heard of a document that gave such a sweeping security clearance. More importantly, she was sure that document had been blank by the time the man had returned it to his pocket. They laid poor Katie down in a bed in the infirmary. Petra wheeled the automatic medical unit over and unravelled the wires on the handheld scanner. She played the machine over Katie's body. Digital spikes climbed and fell on its readout. Petra was aware of the doctor inspecting the white plastic column with its wires, screens and plugs. He seemed amused. Cheaper than a real medic, I guess, he said. Not really, Petra replied. In fact, not at all. The AMU beeped. Heightened serotonin and decreased alpha waves. You see, said the doctor, shock. How come there isn't any greenery around here? I mean, this is England. There's rain. More people arrived. Charlie Bannon, the Grange mechanic, being first. Charlie, bluff and bullish and proud of his Yorkshire ancestry, had news. Carl and Katie's 4x4 is missing. He noticed the newcomer. Ah. Vanessa Stelios Foster arrived next, yawning. Vanessa was a biology student on attachment from the floating Atlantis University. She was also the poshest person Petra had ever met. Vanessa eyed the doctor. Who's he? Petra shook her head. Don't know. Vanessa stopped yawning when she saw the rigid Katie on the camp bed. Oh my God, what's wrong? She had a fright, said the doctor. And I'm the doctor, if anyone's asking. A hand grasped Petra's arm. She shrieked. Katie's grip was tight, unrelenting. The bridge, she whispered. It's all right, Katie, said Petra. You're back in the Grange. Where is Carl? Katie just stared, seeing something none of the others could. Under the bridge, she said. Petra was again looking at a sincere face on the computer screen. However, this was quite a different form of sincere to that of Carl Baring. This sincere had all the sincerity of a government denial. Petra was looking at Hamilton Bryant as the food minister sat in his comfortable air-conditioned ministry in Madrid. 320 million hits on the latest appeal, he was saying. Don't you see what Carl Baring means to them? Bryant flashed brilliant white teeth in a perfect smile. You're doing great work out there. We're alone out here, Petra told him. All the more reason not to worry. You know Carl, he's eccentric. Probably just went for, I don't know, a long walk. He's done it before. You remember that scheme of his to send a balloon to the moon? And Katie, Petra snapped. I suppose his eccentric behaviour extends to putting his sister into shock. You do understand, Petra, said Bryant, that there are a lot of parties who'd like to see the Grange fail. Parties very interested in Carl Baring's ruin and humiliation. So far, you scientists have failed to grow any food of any kind whatsoever. Not very good, is it? And now this? Do you really want to call out the cavalry and let the world know just how badly you're doing? Never mind your own personal reputation, of course. Petra couldn't believe she was saying this out loud. She must be even more scared than usual. After all, at GlobeAid you publicly staked your career on the success of the Grange, and then there's the €2 billion of taxpayers' money you pledged to get the project started. That's unkind, Petra. You know I wouldn't like to think this accident with Carl was the result of some inefficiency with the management of the Grange. Not your fault, of course, but... Petra held her temper. That's low, Minister, even for you. Bryant kept up his grin. Miss Lancaster, Petra, please. There is no problem at the Grange. Carl Baring is not missing, not after one night. I am not about to send in international security and risk this entire project for the sake of one crackpot media darling who decides to go walkies. You tell your farmers to pull their heads out of the dirt and find him. Petra put out a finger to finish the computer call, then paused. And what about this man you sent us?
Who?
This doctor. I've seen his credentials. How come he just happened to turn up at exactly the moment Carl went missing? What's going on?
Bryant looked as if he couldn't care less. I don't know what you're talking about, Petra.
but if you've got an extra pair of hands, I suggest you use them. The 4x4 drove over the barren hills of Hampshire. An eerie sight. Mile after mile of silent brown humps beneath a slate-grey sky.